Hello and welcome to another episode of What Comes Next, a show all about the technologies that will shape your future. I'm Rob Kellner.
I'm Amy Dickens.
And I'm Kwaku Akommensah.
Amy, Kwaku, how are you both doing?
Doing very well, mate. Yeah. Just come off a really exciting call about a fintech mission to Silicon Valley, which is going to be really, really cool. So we're doing some stuff with London and partners. I'm very, very excited about that.
Going to Silicon Valley.
It's a virtual one.
Shame. Not quite back to normality yet, right?
Quite as exciting. But
More exciting than that, Quakes. Please tell us what you did last weekend.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Last weekend,
when you said I just got off an exciting, I was like, here we go. I cannot wait for you to share this. went in a different direction.
Yeah. This last weekend I was in the Lake District with three friends of mine who we're a team called the Yorkshire Terriers, and we were basically taking on a challenge event called Race the Sun, which is a 40-mile cycle, a 2-mile canoe, and then a 11-mile mountain climb, which, to be honest, right, I'm not going to lie, I was definitely the slowest member of the team, and really, it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. But yeah, it was amazing. We started at 6 a.m. in like pitch black, and yeah, raced the sun throughout the day. It took us about 9.5 hours to get through it. It was grueling, but we raised a lot of money for a really cool charity called Action Medical Research. So yeah, it was badass. Will I be doing it again? I am not sure.
I heard this when you did the marathon, though, and then you were all gagging for a new challenge as soon as you'd recovered. So
yeah, I need to figure out what the next thing's going to be. It's the cycle, man. Like those cyclists are no joke. It was they're a very strange breed. But yeah, it was fun. It was really, really fun.
When you say it's one of the hardest things I've ever done, you've run a marathon and you're the father of a young daughter, so you have some perspective of what that means. For me, the hardest thing I've ever done is probably like move a desk from IKEA into an Uber. So like you've really gone some to kind of best yourself there. So congratulations, mate. It sounds like an awesome challenge, an awesome thing to do.
Thanks, man. Yeah, appreciate it. I'm not sure like I can really sort of claim lots of hardship to compare it to, but it certainly felt like it at the time.
I was on the opposite. Opposite end of the scale this weekend, I was sitting on my sofa tracing my family history because my sister sent me a text on Saturday night and she said, do you know what grandma's maiden name is on our dad's side? And I said, yeah, of course I do. And she was asking where she was born and I said her name and where she was born. And then I just like opened up one of these sort of family tracing websites and off I went. I was like on fire all of a sudden, just thinking, oh, I wonder what her parents were called and her parents before that. So yeah, I've been trying to piece together a somewhat unreliable set of records, census records and birth certificates and all that kind of stuff, but super interesting stuff. I highly recommend everyone give it a go. Just to see what you uncover. Sometimes you can't get very far, but it's still pretty interesting stuff.
It's very cool. Yeah, my partner has traced back her auntie has traced back their family tree about 500 years now. It's crazy.
That's amazing.
It's like proper, it turns into a bit of an addiction, and
yeah,
keeps on going further back. Yeah,
yeah. I'm in 1887 now, so not quite 500 years, but
that's pretty cool, though.
A couple generations. Yeah. Yeah. I just really want to find out if Charles Dickens is on there. Not gonna lie.
Rob, what's new in the world of Kellner?
Not too much. I feel like it's my 32nd birthday coming up, and the harsh evidence of this is that in the last couple of days I have fallen ill and sprained my neck for the first time in ages. I did a bit of yoga, and I've always really enjoyed yoga because I've sort of have very tight shoulders and all that kind of stuff. And so I did half an hour of sort of like very, very much beginners, couple of stretches yoga. And the next day I was just, at the office at my computer, turned my neck, heard a like crunch, and then sort of 2 days of just not being able to sort of turn it properly at all. Thankfully on the mend now, but if that doesn't spell kind of getting older, I don't really know what does. So this is nature's little way of reminding me that the birthday's coming up, and And that all things were send.
The creeping sands of time. Mate, I was saying this to one of my friends who was doing this event. We were like, you know you're getting old when you wake up with a sprained neck because you slept incorrectly.
Exactly.
It's like, man, exactly. I've got to have like my perfect like pillow in exactly the right position. Otherwise, even sleep can injure me. Like some kind of frail, brittle bird.
Get yourself a pair of orthopedic shoes, guys. It'll change your life.
What? Orthopedic shoes? You're trying to punt me clogs for a good night's sleep.
No, for wearing around so your back doesn't hurt.
Right. Okay.
Okay. I suppose it's all connected. That kind of makes sense. But you're right. When lying, you know, lying down, basically motionless, becomes a high risk activity. That's when you know. That really is when you know. But anyway, on a slightly more uplifting note, it is time for another installment of Innovation of the Week. This is when Kwaku, Amy, and I share some of our favorite technologies that we've discovered over the last couple of weeks. We always like hearing about new technologies, so if you want to share something your company does or something that you're working on yourself, please do email in. We're wcn@granttree.co.uk. Kwaku, I think this installment, you're up first.
Yes. Okay. So this one is something a little bit different. I haven't focused on a company, but a process that is, I suppose, currently under research at the moment. And it is a process called EPR, Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation. Now, if there are any anaesthetists listening, then I apologize if you already know what this is. But for those of us who don't work in surgery or anesthesia, this is probably going to be something that is relatively new to you. So just as a bit of background, the top cause of death between the ages of 1 and 46 is trauma. So that is everything from car crashes to falls to stab wounds to gunshots, you name it. Basically something that causes trauma to the body. And one of the key reasons for death is the body's bleeding out and cardiac arrest. And so the surgeons that work on trauma patients are always trying to find ways to buy time to treat these bodies that are really in this emergency state where they've only got maybe minutes, maybe even seconds to stop the bleeding and to perform the relevant surgeries on them. So there's this really interesting process that's being trialed at the moment called EPR, Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation. And essentially what that means is the induction of hypothermia, so rapid cooling of the body to stop bleeding and to give the surgeons that are involved time to operate on the body. So why on earth would you want to add the problem of hypothermia to a body that's already suffering from trauma? Well, a body that is suffering from hypothermia needs less oxygen in order to stay alive. There are less free radicals that are moving around the body. There's less inflammation, which is exacerbated by heat. And there's less brain excitation as well. So there's less chance that the body can go into shock. Now, again, that's not without its issues. So what hypothermia also causes is less blood clotting. So again, if you're trying to stop the body from bleeding out, then the one thing you don't want to do is stop the blood from clotting. Essentially, there's going to be more bleeding and there's going to be shivering and stress. So there's this constant balance when you're talking about the use of induced hypothermia between the sort of positives and negatives that that's going to have on the body. So it's the previous thinking in surgery was basically when you're treating a patient, you're trying to keep the body warm, and the hypothermia is a really, really, really bad thing. But there's a fair amount of evidence now that these surgeons in the field have been taking into consideration. And I'll just give you a couple of examples of where the use of hypothermia or the instances of hypothermia have been observed to have been positive on bodies, right? So there's this really interesting phenomenon of cold water drowning. I don't know whether you guys have ever heard of this, but essentially there's lots of examples of people drowning in particularly cold water and managing to stay alive for up to sort of a couple of hours underwater without air, without oxygen, being resuscitated because their bodies have cooled down so quickly that it essentially puts their body on ice. So they're able to be resuscitated. They're able to reoxygenate their tissues in time for the body to stay alive. The other thing is that, another example rather is that newborns with birth defects. So again, you're talking about babies that require oxygen immediately. You're able to slow down the requirement for oxygen by inducing mild hypothermia, and that's how those cardiac surgeons currently operate on newborn babies. And then you also have the use of mild hypothermia in cardiac arrest as well. So again, buying time for the surgeons to operate. So
can I just add this? Sorry, yeah, sure, really interesting. Can I just add, how do you, in a kind of emergency scenario, how do you induce hypothermia? I presume relatively quickly.
Yeah. A very good question. So the first thing to note is that this isn't for every single patient, right? This is still a fairly kind of new type of treatment that's being trialed. And essentially, in this first trial that they're doing, they're trying to test 10 patients that are viable patients for EPR versus 10 that essentially would have been viable patients, but the team that is required for EPR to take place weren't available at the time, so they had to go through the regular resuscitation and CPR and whatnot. Now, there are some really, really important stipulations for if you're going to try something that essentially is like a kind of last line of defense before death. So essentially, that's the first one, right? You've got to have somebody who you're pretty sure is going to die if you don't try something different here, right? So that's the first one, right? The second is that the chest cavity has already been opened. So you're about to give them open chest CPR, right? Which I presume is electrodes directly to the heart. Pretty serious stuff. And then you've tried that and that hasn't worked, right? So that's your stipulation. So you're talking about a fairly kind of narrow group of patients here. But if that does happen, and the patient is deemed to be fit for this trial procedure, what happens next is pretty amazing. So they have a cannula, like a large cannula, a tube which is attached to the aorta of the patient, and it quickly pumps liquid, super cooled liquid saline into the veins and capillaries of the patient, right? So you're basically talking about the quick replacement of blood with cool saline through the entire body, and they drain the blood out of the right side of the heart. So essentially, yeah, they're draining the body of blood, and they're cooling it down to as low as 10 degrees C, so 27 degrees under the regular body temperature. And what that does is it essentially, what they're calling this is a form of suspended animation. Very, very interesting for future applications. And we'll talk about Amy's favorite application for this in a second. So essentially what you're doing is you're slowing down the operating speed, the metabolism of the patient, and then you're giving all of the relevant surgeons the time to work on that body. Are there any questions right now before I continue on this one?
It's funny. It sounds like a sort of X-Men origin story. It sort of happened and it turned into sort of Dr. Yeah. Freeze or whatever. Yeah.
It really does. Like, yeah. who, you know, that the X-Men who doesn't have any blood, it's just all saline.
Yeah.
Do you know how long the body can last at that temperature? Like, because you talked about the sort of cold, what do you call it, cold drowning,
where bodies
could last for a few hours and be resuscitated. But if they're in surgery and they're, you know, their blood has been removed, do you know how long they can last in that scenario?
So I'm not sure how long the maximum is, but the minimum that they look to, or what that you would the minimum amount of time that would, I guess, qualify the procedure as being called EPR would be over 2 hours. So, a pretty significant amount of time. And it's interesting as well. If you only want to preserve the body for like half an hour, then the temperature that you have to go to is slightly higher. So it's not as invasive a procedure. But the longer.
Still sounds pretty invasive, to be fair.
The longer you want the kind of stasis to last, the colder you have to go. That's kind of the way it works.
Can you imagine dropping that one at a Christmas party? Like, oh yeah, I was once on a table, you know, at 10 degrees Celsius with my veins full of saline, and now I'm back. Like, what a story to tell.
It's absolutely incredible. The idea of, you know, I just like sort of imagine what that actually looks like in real life. You know, someone's like chest is open, CPR doesn't work, and then somebody goes, right, okay, it's time to try EPR, and they basically just pump all of your blood out of your body and replace it for this cool saline. It must be such a bizarre situation. And one of the downsides, I suppose, obviously the upside being you may have prolonged the amount of time that you have to save someone's life who otherwise would have almost certainly died. On the downside, the number of different surgeons that are required to perform EPR is much more than the kind of specialized surgeons that would deal with CPR, right? So that there's quite a kind of large resource requirement for this procedure, because a lot of it is, as I say, is still in kind of trial phase. So we're really talking about specialists in the field. And they're trialing this at the moment in Baltimore, Maryland. There's also researchers that are involved in the research in UCL in London as well.
So what you're saying is, if you're going to have a traumatic accident, do it in Baltimore.
Something like that. Well, the trial started in 2018. I wasn't able to find out too much more about how the trial has progressed since then. Presumably that trial of an initial 20 patients is now complete, and they're probably compiling the data from that. But there has been interest voiced from NASA scientists about what this could mean for space travel in the future.
Naturally.
So could there be a situation in which, you know, this application, there's an application of EPR that allows astronauts to go on, you know, deep space voyages. It's interesting. The lead researcher in the in this study basically said there was absolutely no focus on that for this. So he's like completely wrote off that immediately. I didn't want a load of sci-fi nerds contacting them and volunteering. what I wanted to share with you as well is just this this one quote that I thought was quite a kind of interesting sort of scene set, maybe a nice way to kind of finish off on my section. That was from one of the researchers from UCL, I believe, a consultant anesthetist called Ken Fong. And he said, in emergency medicine, we're always trying to blur the line between life and certain death to create something that looks like hope where none previously existed. If EPR works, it'll be a game changer. I thought that was a really cool,
that's beautiful.
Cool thought to finish on.
That is it's a really interesting thought too, because that's destroying the ultimate binary, which is you're either alive or you're dead, right? Because in this situation, you're not alive, but you're not dead.
Yeah.
Very exactly. Strange. Yeah. Mm.
I've got one last question for you, Kwaku, which is, were you particularly worried about the race to the sun in Denver and you were just exploring all possible options, all possible worst case scenarios?
Well, you know what? I wasn't doing that. I was literally like doing the kind of the research for dummies thing of like, what are the coolest things that are going on in medicine right now, and sticking it into Google. And I remembered, I think this is it, like we very briefly touched on it in a previous episode. I thought, well, yeah, this is probably worth a little bit more investigation. So yeah, it wasn't completely selfish. Now, who's up next? Who wants to share their next innovation of the week? Amy, are you?
I think it's me. I think it's me. Yeah. So the product that I'm going to be talking to you about today is called Sonic ASL. And it is a product that was developed by a team at the University at Buffalo in America, in New York. And basically what it is they have modified a set of noise-canceling headphones so that they can see sign language and translate sign language for the person with the headphones on. So a hearing person can wear these headphones, somebody can sign at them, and the headphones can recognize the sign language and translate it, right? So if you guys are familiar with The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams, this is the babblefish, right? This is the little yellow fish that you put in your ear that translates someone's native language into your language, except for this is sign language, which is really, really interesting.
Very, very cool. What was the name of the company again?
Sonic ASL.
Sonic ASL. Okay, fair play. And presumably there's some kind of camera on these headphones. How does the tech work?
So this is what's so cool that I had to wrap my head around this a few times. It uses the Doppler effect, which, to take you guys back to physics, to school physics, the Doppler effect is basically what's observed when a source of waves is moving with respect to the receiver, right? So if you think, like, the classic example is sirens on an emergency vehicle, right? So when you are sitting and listening to, if you're in a car and an emergency vehicle is passing you, I can actually hear an ambulance outside right now. This is quite funny. When the ambulance is approaching you, it's got a really high pitched sound, but as it passes you, it's a low pitched sound. And the reason is because the frequency of the sound wave has shifted in respect to where you are. So there's actually disturbance in the air from the sound, which is, we know sound moves in a wave. So that disturbance is what you're picking up, is the change in frequency. So this basically, these noise canceling headphones have like an outward facing mic. Well, actually all noise canceling headphones have an outward facing microphone. This is how they work, right? They pick up the sound waves from outside and then they give like an inverted kind of wave back to block out the sound. So what these researchers did at the University of Buffalo was they added an additional speaker to see if they could make it sensitive enough to actually sense motion, like by sensing the movement, the change in the frequency of the sound waves. And then they've created an app which basically like identifies the different waves that are made by different hand movements and translates them into the words that those movements correspond to. It's a little bit crazy.
Isn't it Daredevil, the guy who can the blind guy in Marvel that can do that?
Yeah.
That's so true.
Wow. So they've created echolocation for human beings. That's badass.
Essentially, and so they tested it in a couple of different settings, indoors and outdoors. And I should say at the moment they have a very limited vocabulary on this. So I think they've got 42 words and 30 sentences is what they tested. So with the 42 words, both indoors and outdoors, they had a 93.8% accuracy, which is pretty phenomenal. And with the 30 sentences, they had a 90.6% accuracy. So pretty good results for like what to me just seems like an absolutely crazy I find it unbelievable that a set of headphones can detect motion and understand it. But yeah, that it's been a pretty successful testing run.
How close do you have to be stood to the person in order for the headphones to pick up the shape of that sound wave?
They tested it in a situation where it was like a conversational distance, you would, if you put someone sort of on the other side of a train platform 30 feet away, it's probably going to be a less effective communication technique because there are too many other things going on. But if you're having a conversation with someone in like, a normal amount of space that you would have a conversation with someone, it's quite effective. They've said that obviously ASL is an independent language. It's American Sign Language. And that's what this is being tested on. But the algorithm that they've written, the technology, lends itself very well to other sign languages, of which there are over 300 in the world. So, any BSL, we could do this in the UK. We could take this technology. We could feed the feed the AI with all of the BSL words and have a dictionary of BSL spoken words that could be translated, and it would work the same way. So, you know, it is a scalable solution for different sign languages across the world.
Did they say why they didn't go the kind of camera gesture recognition route?
No, they didn't do that. I think they sort of touched a little bit on the fact that cameras can be quite invasive. And it often it has, because when I think about what this technology could be used for, it's very much a one-way communication system at the moment. So it allows a hearing person to understand sign language. But if the deaf person who's speaking sign language doesn't understand spoken lip reading, it doesn't really allow the hearing person the ability to communicate back. So the kind of situation that I thought this might lend itself well to is something like a medical appointment where you want to tell your doctor everything that's happening with you, but you want to use the language you're fluent in to be as descriptive as you possibly can. And for most ASL or BSL speakers, their first language is sign language. So that's the one that they have the most fluidity with. They have the most descriptive words that they can use. But unless a doctor understands that, it's very, very, like, that communication is, it's such a huge gap, right? So to be able to go to a doctor and give them these headphones and sign everything you need to sign and have them understand it, you know, it's that conversation, like, it is a two-way conversation, but the hard part is getting all the detail over, which is what's happening. So you were talking about video. So I think in that kind of situation, like, obviously that's a situation where having an interpreter could be awkward because it could be confidential, but also you don't necessarily want video there because it's not necessarily something you want to have recorded, or, you know, there's just that kind of extra barrier of, like, vulnerability there that you maybe don't necessarily want visual records of. So yeah, it's a really good solution for this kind of one-way communication.
Yeah, that's a really, I think the doctor's example is fantastic. And, you know, I suppose there are lots of situations in life where communication is, if not entirely one way, it's much more kind of one way than like a sort of regular social conversation. So, like, I'm thinking of like an academic viva where you're defending a thesis, maybe, where it's like, you know, you want to do the majority of the communication and your explanation and sort of you want to handle most of the discussion in the language that's most suitable for you and most comfortable for you, because that will give you the best chance of communicating what you need to. So that's really interesting.
And I think it opens up this other, like, really fun side to things too, which is what, like, creativity, for example. So you can potentially have people who write an entire play in sign language and they can communicate it to a full audience, because an audience can wear these and can listen to the whole play and have it translated, but the actors can act in sign language. So, like, if you have a hearing member in the audience, they can participate and they can enjoy it. But, you know, it doesn't have to be translated into a spoken language to be able to enjoy it. So I think there's, like, a lot of really fun uses for it too, as well as the actual, like, serious uses for it. I revisited the Signly episode that when Kwaku interviewed Signly, I was doing my research for this and kind of reminded myself that written language is not always accessible for deaf people. So written language as a solution isn't, like, we know this from what Mark Applin said from Signly, it's not always the best solution. Spoken language can alleviate that. So yeah, this is just a way to kind of help bridge that communication gap, really. So yeah, I was pretty impressed with what they're doing.
That's awesome. The performance example too, brilliant. Like, where you need, where, you know, things like rhythm come into play, right? Where it's not simply like, here's the text version of it, or even I think even if there was a camera that maybe captured gestures, you wouldn't necessarily, you actually lose a bit of almost intimacy there if you can have something that's translated, you know, in your ear speaking to you. You can play with things like rhythm and pacing much more, I suppose, than you could in any other sort of form of that translation.
I should mention the next stage that they're working on, as well as adding more vocabulary, is to get the microphone to pick up facial expressions, because sign language is actually, a lot of it is about facial expression too. That's how they emphasize words. That's how they, like, sometimes they use different syllables will be a facial expression. It can communicate emotion or like intent behind a word. So that's a really, really key part of sign language as well, which right now the app is kind of, or the headphones are less adept to. So they're trying to work on that next, is how it picks up facial expressions, because then you can really get the whole feel for the language and be able to translate it really slickly. I think it sounds incredible. I really hope that this is a thing that, you know, becomes like Google Translate, where there's maybe a few awkward translations, but for the most part, you really get the point across. That would be ideal.
Also, like the expansion of that technology into just understanding more things that are going on in your physical environment and giving you an audio cue for them. So, you know, if this technology is already able to pick up on like a difference in hand movements, presumably it's not going to be that long until it will be able to pick up like, I don't know, like a different shape on someone's body. Like, okay, like that, there's like a gun on that person's body, or I don't know, there are three people walking behind that wall or something like that. You know, it's going to be that long until the reverberation of a sound wave can be analyzed to, you know, some crazy extent to give you an audio reading.
We already do that, right? Like we have radar and sonar, those things exist. But yeah, sonar tracking things under the sea and stuff like that, we definitely already do that. But yeah, I just think this kind of tiny micro one is really interesting. Like that, like, I don't know, it just blows my mind that headphones can track your hand movements. That's so crazy to me. Rob, what do you have for us today?
Yes, so for my innovation of the week. So so obviously last episode we spoke to eConsult and we spoke about the idea of sort of creating this digital layer between kind of doctors and patients, and then kind of using this layer as a way to kind of collect medical information from patients and then feed it into doctors, and then allowing or empowering kind of doctors and other medical professionals to treat patients based on the information they collect. And we talked briefly about the idea that while eConsult at the moment just collects kind of subjective human data, i.e. I feel this way, I have this pain, this, you know, that kind of thing, that, you know, eventually you could feed in things like wearable data straight to doctors and they would be sort of able to make medical decisions based on that. And so I sort of did some digging in that area because I think that's quite got a cool space. And I found this company, which is co-headquartered in Boston and Edinburgh, called Current Health. And basically, they've created a platform that combines this all-in-one wearable with a telemedicine offering, so kind of remote medical care, to support patients with 100 different kinds of diseases from the comfort of their own home.
They are wearing like a watch or whatever it is.
Yeah, so it's basically this. So it's a sort of disc-shaped sensor. It sits at kind of the top of your arm. If you've seen sort of the modern kind of sort of diabetes,
like a nicotine patch.
Yeah, exactly. There's lots of sort of things I think that sort of sit in that part of your arm. So if you imagine sort of the top of your tricep around there. And it's it basically can measure a whole bunch of stuff. So respiration rate, pulse, oxygen saturation, body temperature. And according to Current Health, it's the smallest, most accurate all-in-one wearable on the market. And it's the same accuracy as an ICU monitor.
Wow.
The same accuracy as the sensors they use in intensive medical care. And yes,
but you're just wearing it all day.
And you're wearing it, exactly, and you're wearing it all day. So you're going about sort of your life, or obviously you might be sort of at home in bed, or you could be going about your life. But basically that obviously that then collects data throughout the day, or collects data live, in fact, and then feeds it to this kind of platform. And then doctors can just sort of sit and monitor it. And then it kind of gives alerts to doctors or, you know, to other medical professionals based on the kinds of things they're looking out for. So obviously these variables change depending on what kind of sort of disease or kind of issue you have. And they basically look at different combinations of those variables, how they might change if you've got a particular problem. And then basically just pings the doctor saying, this is happening, this patient, this might be wrong, I want to check up on them. And they can just sort of, you know, the equivalent of sort of FaceTime video chat the patient straight away and say, is everything okay? You know, this happened. Or they can call them into the hospital or doctor's office or whatever. And yeah, the monitoring is continuous. And yeah, it's basically part of this space called kind of care at home. And the idea is that as wearables and sort of digital data collection and management has become better, there's been less of a need to have a patient actually in the hospital taking up a sort of regular or intensive care bed. And so the more patients that you can sort of treat remotely that are sort of less danger effectively, the less pressure you put on hospitals, the less pressure you put on sort of medical staff at hospitals. And obviously patients tend to be happier at home. So this is kind of, you know, there's lots of sort of benefits there. And it's been really interesting during COVID, obviously, where, you know, one of the big variables in terms of sort of mortality rate is hospital capacity. And so they've done lots of kind of interesting work there. And what they've been doing is they call them low acuity patients. So people who are suffering from a disease, but not so badly, they need to be in hospital. They're essentially looking after them at home. And then through this wearable, they can look at things like oxygen saturation. So if you're sort of, you know, suffering quite badly from COVID, then your lungs are impacted, your oxygen saturation goes down. That can be really, really dangerous. But they can monitor that safely from home, and they can see, you know, how things are going, if your temperature increases because of reinfection and so on. But essentially they can be much more comfortable at home. It's also better for those patients because they might have COVID, but obviously they don't want to bring it into hospital, not only because there are kind of other immunocompromised people there, but also there are, you know, doctors and nurses and people you don't want to be infected. So you're decreasing the overall level of exposure people have to COVID while making sure they're sort of safe and sound at home. And I think it's just such a cool little, you know, I say little, it's just brilliant. I think it's brilliant. It's a massive thing. Yeah.
I imagine it's the kind of thing that would also be really great for terminal patients who, you know, they're kind of at the end of their life. They know there's not necessarily any like treatment that's going to save their life. It's just a matter of having the correct medication and being comfortable. But obviously being at home and being able to be treated from your own bed, your own house, is infinitely better than spending your last few weeks in hospital or hospice or wherever you may be. Yeah. I imagine something like this would potentially help with people in that situation where, you know, they don't have to be in hospital. They just basically need to make sure their medication is keeping them comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that their vital signs are, you know, what they should be.
Yeah, exactly. And if you need to intervene, I think that's absolutely right. I think there's lots of cases where, you know, patient kind of comfort is you know, really important. You know, I think you're absolutely right for patients in kind of palliative care, but also, you know, I think there are lots of sort of conditions where sort of kind of home TLC is actually more effective treatment than being in hospital and being kind of strapped up and monitor everything, because, you know, your sleep will be better, you'll feel just happier being at home. And obviously that's kind of really important to the treatment process as well. There's another interesting use case, which is drug testing, also sort of drug studies, because what they can do. So obviously how a drug study works generally is, you know, you take a drug however many times you theoretically should need it in the, you know, once it actually comes to market, but then you need to kind of quite regularly monitor how people are doing, because it's sort of in the experimental phase. You're not sure if there are any sort of side effects or any other kind of dangers that you weren't aware of previously that came out in sort of the first studies. And so this not only allows you to do that in a more convenient way. You don't have to have a patient come into, you know, I don't know, doctors or hospital every kind of week, but also you get much more data on how the medication affects them over time, like while they sleep, where, and obviously the patient isn't in a position to report on the effects of the medicine on something that happens while they sleep, they might not notice. And so you're getting much more information on, yeah, the cycle of how drugs work, which can really sort of speed up delivery times and also help kind of tailor dosages and things like that to patients much more easily. So I think it's a really cool, I mean, it sort of speaks to some of the issues we were talking about on the last episode, where, you know, generally relieving in England, the NHS, and I guess other sort of medical institutions of some of that kind of less necessary burden is a real positive, because they're so, you know, they're so stretched and so overworked that actually these sort of solutions are ways to kind of do that effectively without compromising the quality of care.
And I think the data point that you brought up is also really important, because, you know, we know historically that women have been pretty much excluded from medical research because they're just considered problematic because they menstruate. But with mass amounts of data, you are actually able to isolate a group of people given by their sort of biological gender, and would be able to look at like for drug testing, look at how reactions are occurring in those people at different times of the month, different hormone fluctuations. Like that would potentially be a real step up for women's health as well. So that's
a great point. I didn't think about that. Yeah, it's absolutely true. And they, you know, they, I think they've already collected sort of 1 million, I think, patients worth of data through this kind of service. So it's, like I said, it's co-headquartered in Edinburgh and Boston. And so I think there's much more uptake in America, but partly because as private institutions, they have a bit more flexibility to adopt the solutions like this quicker. But there are hospitals in the UK using it too. And so they are collecting lots of data, and then they're applying the usual kind of like machine learning algorithms to this data to kind of look for patterns. And like you say, that should bring out lots of interesting trends in kind of previously sort of a kind of underobserved groups of people, women particularly, but lots of people that, you know, aren't sort of generally well off white men. And so I think that's, you know, there's definitely a sort of impact of that.
I suppose, yeah, the applications for preventative medicine are going to be pretty amazing as well, because you're going to have let's say somebody is wearing one of these wearables for a month, and then there's an incident of particular interest to the doctors. Well, you can then essentially rewind all of their data feeds for the last month to see what the precursors to that event were. And if you have enough data from enough patients, you can probably start to piece together a lot more of those kind of unlikely sort of weird and wonderful precursors to a given event, whether that be a heart attack or a stroke or an asthma attack or anything else. I've heard about wearables in this sort of market that are looking to bring in external data as well. So take the asthma attack example, things like pollen count in the air. So you'd have something that could actually alert you and say, well, you know, you probably don't want to be going for a particularly strenuous day of exercise today because of these precursors, because of this medication that you're taking, because of this existing condition, and the fact that there's high pollen count out. So just be aware. So it starts.
I even need that for hay fever. Just don't go outside today. It's not going to be worth your time.
Yeah. But you can see, like, the more data that's brought into this, you know, it's going to start yielding some really interesting like changes in behavior for patients, and a lot more kind of liberation to live with ongoing diseases and whatnot. It sounds like a really interesting company.
For sure. And I think liberation is a really good way to sum it all up. It's that we have reached a point technologically where we don't have to keep patients in rooms surrounded by kind of heavy, noisy machinery. We have now compressed that machinery into a sort of accurate and durable enough state that we can now wear it out in the world, living our lives, right? So you're instantly, that is liberation. That's such a kind of massive improvement in your quality of life if you compare the two kind of extremes, right? You know, spending a week in a hospital or being able to kind of, you know, walk around, be at home, do, you know, return to sort of, you know, normality. You know, it's such a win-win, I think, for both the medical side of things and the patient side of things. Yeah, I think, like you say, it's going to go in some really interesting directions in the future. All right, that's it for this episode of Innovation of the Week. Thank you very much for listening. Once again, if you have a technology or a company you would like to recommend and hear on Innovation of the Week, you can email us at wcn@grantree.co.uk. Amy Kwaku, see you guys in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, see you soon. Thanks for listening.
See you later.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of What Comes Next. Make sure you don't miss an episode by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. We're trying to get the word out about the show, so if you have time, please share it with friends or leave a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. If you have any questions about what we've discussed on this episode, or would like to talk about your own technology on the podcast, then drop us an email. We're at wcn@grantree.co.uk. Thank you very much again. See you next time.